You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
And you're with Wednesday Breakfast.
Yes, good morning. You're here with myself, Jesse.
And me, Sonia.
And Nita's there as well.
Behind the panel.
Thank you, Nita.
There have been some updates, so she's looking around at things and we'll be there in a minute.
But we can do a rundown.
We can.
So, we'll have
first up
news headlines.
Oh, we should, but before we even start that, we should say thank you to Earth Matters.
Oh, yes.
Segment on localization, and then hearing from Bunjalung Elder about the importance of women in the environment movement.
Thank you. And Earth Matters is 3CR's national program for social justice and environment issues.
Mm-hmm. So then, on the show today, who's our first interview?
So bright and early, we'll interview Marcus Rubenstein. And Marcus is an independent journalist with more than 25 years of media experience. I won't say too much more than that. I'll, of course, do more of an interview later on, more of an introduction, I should say. But then following that, I'll play the first part of a multi-part interview I did with the amazing Sasha Gillies-Lukakis. And we have a chat about Cuba all things Cuba. It's quite in-depth, but enjoyable, and Sasha's just amazing. So I'm very excited about that.
And then at 8 o'clock, we will be talking with Gail Page, who is talking to us for our regular monthly slot with Médecins Sans Frontières. Gail was actually an HR professional, but she's worked in Afghanistan. She was twice in Palestine. She was in Jerusalem in both 2023 and 2024. So she's got a trove of stories to share with us. And we'll be talking to her after 8 o'clock.
And then we'll have quite a few community announcements. There's a lot going on, of course, and some music in between.
And that will be our show for this morning.
That'll be it.
So thank you all very much for joining us. It is now 7:03. You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM, and Wednesday Breakfast on the 12th of March.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
And we'll begin with news headlines for the 12th of March, 2025. It's 7:03. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast. And we'll begin in Africa, where the Alliance of Sahel States, comprising Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, marked a significant step toward regional autonomy by unveiling a new flag on February 22nd, following its exit from the West's neo-colonial institution, ECOWAS, in January 2024. The flag, featuring an orange sun over a baobab tree and a united silhouette of the three nations against a green backdrop, symbolizes growth, unity, and a break from French and Western influence, reflecting the bloc's push for self-reliance since its formation in September 2023. Beyond symbolism, the Alliance of Sahel States has launched practical integration measures, including a Sahel-wide passport system and a joint military force to combat Al-Qaeda and ISIS-linked insurgencies, alongside plans for a single currency to replace the French-tied CFA franc. The alliance's decolonization efforts, such as expelling French troops, removing colonial judicial wigs in Burkina Faso, and replacing imperialist monuments, have gained widespread support across Africa, positioning the Alliance of Sahel States as a model for sovereignty amid shifting geopolitical tides.
And moving to the Philippines, where former Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte was arrested on Tuesday at Manila Airport under an ICC warrant for crimes against humanity tied to his supposed war on drugs, which killed an estimated 12,000 to 30,000 people, mostly poor urban men, between 2011 and 2019. The 80-year-old, detained after returning from Hong Kong, resisted arrest on the plane, declaring, "You will just have to kill me," despite recently claiming he'd accept his fate for the brutal campaign he championed since his 2016 election. Duterte's arrest follows years of controversy, with police defending the killings as self-defense, while rights groups allege evidence tampering, and comes amid a political shift as President Marcos, once opposed to ICC involvement, now signals cooperation ahead of midterm elections. Duterte's daughter, Vice President Sara Duterte, faces impeachment over corruption and threats, while Duterte's legal team decries the arrest as unlawful. Human rights advocates, on the other hand, are celebrating it as a step toward justice for his deadly legacy.
Into West Asia, where the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights has reported that violence since Thursday has claimed over 1,018 lives, including 745 Alawite civilians killed by security forces and allied groups in recent massacres, with an Alawite source in Europe estimating over 4,000 deaths in the coastal region. The Islamist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, which toppled Bashar al-Assad in December, vows to protect minorities. But escalating hostilities in Tartus, Latakia, Homs and Hama have left women and children among the victims, with bodies littering streets and residents fleeing to the mountains. Local sources confirm hundreds dead in massacres across villages such as al-Sanobar and Bustan al-Bashar, while Syrian security blocks foreign access to unaffected areas, prompting a UN call to end hostilities and ensure humanitarian aid under international law. The United Nations notes widespread displacement and infrastructure damage as militias continue crimes along the coast, deepening the crisis and drawing global concern over the fate of Syria's Alawite and other minorities.
In the United States, the US Space Force is racing to develop the Golden Dome missile defense system, while Vice Chief Lieutenant General Michael Goethlin announced a progress report due to the White House by month's end, emphasizing the need for orbit testing to counter ballistic, hypersonic, and cruise missile threats. Stemming from a January executive order by President Donald Trump, who recently urged Congress to fund the initiative, the system aims to bolster national security with space-based sensors and interceptors targeting missiles in their boost phase. Speaking at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation, Goethlin, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, highlighted the project's urgency as the Space Force shifts into full planning mode to meet White House expectations. The so-called Golden Dome builds on Trump's vision to enhance US defense capabilities through advanced space technology, aligning with broader efforts to protect against evolving global threats, though its successes hinge on securing authorization and funding amidst other domestic and international priorities.
And closer to home here in Australia, a declassified document reveals NATO's expanding influence in the Indo-Pacific, collaborating with New Zealand civil society groups like Asia New Zealand Foundation and Centre for Strategic Studies during a 2023 visit by 9 representatives to counter hybrid warfare from China, Iran and Russia. The alliance is funding these groups to promote its narrative, framing regional security as linked to Europe's amid Ukraine's war, while news media echo NATO's push for militarization without scrutiny. NATO's strategy includes monitoring threats via its Information Environment Assessment and Rapid Response Group, boosting military presence through naval deployments and alliances like AUKUS, and deepening ties with Indo-Pacific 4 partners, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea, for intelligence and interoperability. This reflects a broader Western effort to shape public opinion, counter China's economic development, and reinforce US-led security architecture in the Pacific, raising questions about the role of opaque funding for so-called independent organizations whose primary purpose is advancing NATO's geopolitical goals.
And even closer to home, Greens MP Gabrielle de Vitry said on Twitter yesterday evening that the Premier has just confirmed that there will be no public housing rebuilt after North Melbourne and Flemington public housing is demolished. She further said that Labor is giving public land to a private consortium to design, build and manage what will be private community housing. So residents' rent will be determined by the private housing provider. The majority of the housing built on the sites will, however, be expensive private apartments. Gabriel De Vitry says that the announcement confirms our fears that this government is washing their hands of public housing in Victoria. Labour is handballing people's lives and the housing crisis to a private company.
And finally, over to China, where there is a new Chinese AI application named Manus, which is in closed beta, has sparked excitement with demo footage showcasing its ability to handle resume screening, real estate research, and stock analysis. Though its team admits it's far from complete, grappling with model hallucinations and speed issues. Unlike the open source DeepSeek, which excels at generating answers, Manus focuses on task execution and multi-agent collaboration, integrating advanced AI into a user-friendly product that simplifies complex workflows. While experts laud Manus's engineering innovation over algorithmic breakthroughs, its true potential awaits mass user feedback post-launch, with practicality seen as the key to rivaling DeepSeek's popularity, per Pan Helin of China's tech ministry. It's still in development. Manus reignites debates about AI's next big leap, with its success still to be determined once it moves beyond the beta testing period. And they have been the news headlines for this morning. It's 11 past or 12 past 7, depending on which clock you're looking at. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on 855-3CR. And you could be listening on your radio, on the website, and through the playback service.
Or the community radio listen app, which is my favorite.
The app. And, and hello to everyone in the future. We hope you're having a great day. We might head to
some announcements.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
And we'll head to a quick song. This is an old one from 1988 by Lakim Shabazz, Pure Righteousness.
It will not address the deep underlying issues that still pervade Australian society. And that primary issue is white Australian racism.
We've got a clear-cut case here of intentional genocide from the get-go, from the round table in England.
The true history in this country isn't told. The government always say that they're committed to a truth-telling process. Well, where is your truth-telling process?
I really believe that at the end of the day, the truth will emerge. You can't fight against the truth. It's an unstoppable force. It's indestructible. So deal with it.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
And you're listening to Wednesday Breakfast. It's now 18 minutes past 7. We just heard a song, Lakim Shabazz, Pure Righteousness. Lakim Shabazz is from New Jersey and was a member of the Flavor Unit crew with the 45 King, who is a legendary producer of that time. And Lakim Shabazz, as the name suggests, was also a member of the Nation of Islam and Five Percenters. And you can have a look into that if you're interested. It's an interesting piece of history. And of course, Malcolm X was also part of that that broader group. So we're going to head to an interview I did with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis. So Sasha would be a familiar voice to any regular 3CR listeners. In addition to co-hosting the Latin American Update and the Unitarian Half Hour, Sasha is a regular contributor to shows like Tuesday Home Time and a host of other programs here on 3CR. Sasha is a PhD researcher in the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics in the Spanish and Latin American Studies at the University of Melbourne, and their research focuses on Cuba-Pacific Islands cooperation in education and healthcare development in the Global South and South-South cooperation. Sasha has traveled extensively throughout Cuba, Fiji, Solomon Islands, and Tonga for research and institutional collaborations, focusing on fostering exchanges between the countries. Sasha is also an incredible mind on all things Cuba, Latin America, and beyond, and an extremely gracious guest and generous person all around. So in this recording, in this first part, we'll have quite a few parts. Maybe not quite a few, but a few over the next weeks. And because we had such a great conversation, so I had to cut it into a few different parts. But we're focusing on Cuba and all the important things that we need to know about Cuba. And in this part, we're focusing on the history, on the colonization by Spain and the subsequent independence wars.
Cuba is one of the most, for me, one of the most interesting and instructive case studies when we're looking at, you know, not just Latin American countries, but any country that has been colonized, because it really, I think, has come to emulate the extremes, you know, between what can be achieved when true liberation, true sovereignty is actually finally gained and, you know, fought for. But equally, you know, that, you know, we need to understand the really awful and dark history that precedes that and that leads to, you know, an entire island rising up and achieving that freedom, because it was one of the first countries to be colonized by Spain in the Americas. The Spanish, well, it was Christopher Columbus who arrived in Cuba in 1492 on his first voyage. The only country he visited before that was the Dominican Republic and Haiti, so the island of Hispaniola, which is next to Cuba. And Havana was established not too long after, maybe 15 years later, in about 1514, so 15, 20 years after the first settlement of the island. And from that time onwards, the Spanish were extremely rapacious. Their particular style of colonialism was centered on the extraction, the mass extraction of resources, and pretty much the, you know, the total use of the labor force on the island, which was, of course, indigenous people. The Taino, the Arawak people who were driven to extinction. There are no indigenous people left in Cuba because the Spanish completely exterminated them or worked them to death after colonization. And, you know, very sadly, the only legacy, you know, if we're talking about the people and the culture that has been left on Cuba is, well, to be blunt, it's, you know, the mixed race. Children of Spanish men, Spanish soldiers raping indigenous women. And that's how, the indigenous culture and bloodline has been passed down until today, because there are still people that, you know, do claim some sort of indigenous ancestry in Cuba, but it's, you know, very, very mixed with African people who have come over as slaves, with Spanish people, other Europeans. So there's no distinct indigenous group in Cuba today. Like there is in other Latin American countries. And of course, when the Spanish did, you know, exterminate the indigenous people, they then needed a new labor force. And of course, there weren't enough Spaniards going over at this time, because the Spaniards knew that, you know, Cuba was, there was opportunity, but there was a lot of danger as well. You know, it's very far from mainland Spain. It's a new environment. You know, there's all of this competition with England, with the Dutch, with all of these other powers in the Caribbean. So it was a dangerous place, and the risks outweighed the rewards at this early stage. So the Spanish then turned to slavery, to the African slave trade, and bought hundreds of thousands of slaves at first, and it ended up becoming millions of slaves by the 1800s. And this was the entire basis, you know, of the foundation of Cuba as a sort of political entity in the modern day, that it was a sugar plantation economy. That was the main crop. That was the main resource the Spanish extracted. They found that the conditions were perfect, you know, fertile grounds, very, very lush terrain, constant sunshine, you know, throughout the year, didn't matter. And then when there wasn't sunshine, there was plenty of rain. So that, again, helped the sugar crop grow. and the Spanish pretty much turned it into a monoculture. There were certain other crops. There was some coffee. There was a little bit of livestock rearing. No mining yet to speak of, even though they have now found some nickel reserves. But that's a more recent discovery that's happened after the Spanish, well after the Spanish were forced out of the island. This is the sort of contradiction that Cuba became when you had a fabulously wealthy colony. In fact, it was the crown jewel of the Spanish Empire. And it accounted at one point, after Haiti, after the Haitian Revolution, when that sugar crop collapsed, it accounted for 60 to 70% of global sugar exports. So not just Spain, but for the entire planet. So Cuba was so, so wealthy, and particularly, those Spanish lords who owned property on the island lived like kings. Some of them even lived better probably than the nobles and the kings of Spain. That's how wealthy they were. But you have this contradiction that all of that wealth was built on slavery, that it was built on the toil and the labor and the deaths, of course, of hundreds of thousands and, across five centuries, millions of African people. And then there were on the side, there were indentured, white Spanish laborers, poorer people who had come over to try and make a name for themselves, because conditions in mainland Spain were equally dire, regardless, if you were poor in the colonies or in Spain itself, life was tough. So some people did end up going over to Cuba, to other colonies, and ended up as virtually as slaves or indentured laborers themselves. And you had this bubbling contradiction that there were, it was a vastly larger slave or indentured laborer population as compared to a very tiny planter elite and commercial elite in Havana and some of the other major cities. And you had, throughout the 1800s, you had the liberation wars across the rest of Latin America, and almost the entire continent freed itself through very, very costly wars, but ultimately wars that allowed them to prevail over the Spanish and get their freedom. But the exception was Cuba and Puerto Rico. And this is very unique in the context of Latin America, because the Cuban elite basically saw that they had a better chance of surviving with their money intact if they maintained their allegiance to Spain. The elites of the other Latin American countries saw, that they weren't getting enough from the Spanish crown, that their countries were being exploited and that they themselves were being exploited. There was a bit of a sort of self-interest with a lot of these leaders. Others, of course, like Simon Bolivar from Venezuela, they had that very altruistic vision, of a united, independent Latin America. But the Cuban elite, the local Cuban-born elite, which was of Spanish descent, but they were born in Cuba, they at this time decided that they would hedge their bets by staying with Spain, that, it was safer to, maintain the status quo, because they were still making plenty of money off the sugar plantation economy. But when the rest of the Cuban population, particularly the African slaves, saw what was happening in the rest of the continent, and then they saw, of course, the American Revolution, which at the time, was also a source of inspiration for these movements, they began to agitate. We saw a lot of different slave uprisings throughout the early 1800s. There was a very famous one in the 1830s led by a woman, actually, called Carlota. That's all we know about her. Her name was Carlota, and she led a slave uprising that ended up attracting over 200 slave plantations. So the entire slave populations of 200 plantations around Cuba rallying behind this woman to lead an insurrection against the Spanish. Ultimately unsuccessful, the Spanish put it down, and Carlota was executed along with a lot of the slaves, and the rest were sent back to work on the plantations. But it just went to show that, the maintenance of the relationship with Spain wasn't basically accepted by the majority of the population. And that culminated by the 1860s with the growth of, a domestic Cuban nationalist movement among the upper class, middle class Cubans who wanted their own independent republic, who were inspired by these Latin American countries. And by 1868, we had the beginning of the first Cuban independence war. Now, if we include the Cuban Revolution itself as an independence war, and in Cuba, that's how the history is taught, that that's the final independence struggle, the third and final one. But the first one was in 1868, which was called the 10 Years' War, because it lasted for 10 years. And that was led by Carlos Manuel de Céspedes, who was a wealthy member of the Cuban elite in Havana. But he was a very well-educated, enlightened individual who was sympathetic to all of these Latin American independence movements. And he declared the first Cuban government in arms. So it wasn't recognized by Spain. It wasn't really recognized by any European power, but he declared that this was the first Cuban government, Cuban insurrectionary government. And he led the forces of this insurrection. He drew a lot of people to his side, including a man who would then join the second independence war. His name was Antonio Maceo. He was a slave. He was born to a slave woman and a wealthy planter. So he had a very interesting mixed background. And he and his family were the first landowners to free the slaves on their properties. And they joined Cespedes in this initial war and fought a very grueling 10-year battle against the Spanish, which ultimately, sadly, led to capitulation by some of the other leaders of this movement. And Spain managed to force them to the negotiating table, and they agreed to basically increased autonomy for Cuba, but not independence. The Spanish said, we'll give you autonomy, which really meant very little because the planters were virtually autonomous anyway. They did what they wanted. They didn't really care what the Spanish crown said, so long as they were paying some taxes to the crown. And what happens is a lot of these leaders were rounded up, including Cespedes, and thrown in jail or sent into exile in Spanish prisons. And that was that for the next 25, 30 years until 1895, where we have the second Cuban independence war. And this is called the Little War because it was only from 95 to 98, much, much shorter. And this is where we have, of course, José Martí. This is where he comes into the picture. He'd been writing and agitating, you know, this is the Cuban national hero. He was a poet, literary activist, author. He's regarded as the national hero of Cuba, as the apostle of Cuba, as he's called in Cuba today. And he, in the lead up to this 1895 war, was constantly agitating for Cuban independence, and not just for a superficial independence, but for a Cuba that was genuinely sovereign, that could take charge of its own affairs and that would not be influenced by other countries. And he was one of the first as well to sort of see through perhaps the false promises of the United States and the American Revolution. A lot of the other Cuban independence fighters were quite inspired by it, and they thought they could find an ally in the United States against Spain, because the US, of course, you know, at that time professed to be, you know, a new Republican country that was fighting against the old European colonies. But Martí was very, very prescient when it came to this issue, and he warned. He said the United States is not going to be Cuba's friend. And he wrote a lot about this as well, because he visited the United States on several occasions. He saw the way Latin American people lived there. He saw the way indigenous people lived there. And he said, trust me, the United States is not what you think it is. It's not going to be the savior of Cuba. Because there were even some of these Cuban people who, just to get away from Spain, advocated becoming a state of the US, advocated, you know, annexing Cuba to the southern United States, and it would become another slave state of the US. That's what some people wanted. But Martí said, this will not give you true independence, and we cannot rely on them. We have to fight this war ourselves, and we have to defeat Spain ourselves if we want to be a truly independent Cuba. And they did. They fought very valiantly, and they fought Spain to the point where they broke the Spanish army. Unfortunately, what happened in 1898 was the Americans did intervene, exactly as Martí had predicted, right at the tail end of the war. And America then had this very, very opportunistic moment where a US ship in Havana Harbor blew up, the USS Maine. And they had said the Spanish blew it up. The Spanish have denied this to this day. They said that they never blew it up. I think, you know, we don't know for certain, but most of the historical analysis has come to the conclusion that the Americans blew it up themselves as basically an excuse to start fighting a war against Spain, because they saw, you know, it wasn't just Cuba that was up for grabs. It was Puerto Rico as well, and the Philippines, which was fighting its own revolutionary war against the Spanish. So right at the last minute, you know, the last tail end years of this war in 1898, the Americans swoop in. Of course, they crush Spain, which has already got a very aging navy, very outdated military strategy. The Cubans and the Filipinos were on the verge of defeating the Spanish at this time without the Americans. Of course, the Americans come in, they present themselves as the saviors, and they say, oh, well, we were the ones who, you know, arrived and drove out the Spanish in the final moment, and now we're going to take control of these countries of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines. And they essentially establish what was a military dictatorship in Cuba. Similar things happen in Puerto Rico and the Philippines, but in Cuba, this lasts until 1902. And it's ruled directly by a US Marine who answers to Washington. There's no sort of democracy or anything, you know, as the US often professes that it wanted to introduce. They put down the independence movement. Anyone who is against this US occupation and who is still agitating for independence is exiled, jailed, killed. Martí was killed during the war itself by the Spanish, so he had already passed away, as did Antonio Maceo, who was that, you know, slave slash upper Spanish mix. He passed away. And basically he then paid off, the US then paid off the other members of the Cuban independence movement. And one of them, who was the son of one of these independence figures, Gómez, Máximo Gómez, would become a member of the US-backed elite. So, you know, a very, very sad turn of events, where a lot of these people who started off with very noble aspirations get co-opted by the US machine, you know, the US bribery machinery. And by 1902, though, there have been uprisings, there's been a lot of unrest. And so the Americans say, we're relinquishing control. Cuba will be independent, in scare quotes, but it will be controlled by this elite that we have cultivated over the past 5-6 years.
And that was part one of a long discussion that I had with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis about Cuba, and we spoke about the history there of colonization and the beginnings of the independence wars. Listeners will probably be familiar with Sasha, who's an amazing mind on all things Latin America.
Yeah, Sasha is incredible. I learn so much every time I hear him speak. I'm really struck by a lot of, I guess, tropes, you know, coming out of, I suppose, Cuba's history. So one of them is the false flag attack used as an excuse to invade the country, you know.
Classic.
America to blow up their own ship.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, I didn't realize, I learned just today, I did not know that this was, you know, what happened, I guess, for Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. So they had sort of fought their own independence wars and were about to be independent, only for America to come in at the last moment and go, hey, we're the saviors, and now we're dominating you again.
I was very aware of it in the Philippine context. I mean, from Southeast Asia and things like that, although it's not something that's ever taught or even really discussed much, certainly not in Malaysia at any rate. But I've been very interested in that side of the Filipino history and the early independence movements, because they've provided a model for a lot of philosophy and things across Southeast Asia, Jose Rizal and his writings in particular.
And classic move by the United States to come in at the last minute and go, hey, look,
we'll save you.
Look how great we did and claim the good work of others, World War II and the anti-fascist Red Army.
Yeah. If you loved listening to Sasha, which you did, didn't we all? that was only part one, and we'll continue to play the following parts on Wednesday breakfast, so keep it locked. But also, Sasha has done a history of a lot of Latin American countries. Mostly that can be found on Tuesday home time, and that can be found on the 3CR website. I think I've heard Venezuela, Colombia, Bolivia, Peru, just about everything. Really incredible. Yeah.
I'm going to have to go back and check those out.
Yeah. So we might go to a song. I've got a song here by Imbilia Bell, Nakai Nairobi. And that was Imbilia Bell with Nakai Nairobi. And Imbilia is otherwise known as the Queen of African Rumba, which is maybe not surprising to anyone who's just heard that amazing song. Beautiful rhythms and dancing and a great film clip if you want to have a look.
And listeners who are paying attention may realize that we're not exactly following what we said we would be doing in the rundown at the start of the show. There's been a couple of adjustments, and one of them is that we will now be going to a recording with May Saif, who's a Palestinian activist, Free Palestine Melbourne organizer, and a member of the Palestinian Community Association for Victoria. We'll be playing a clip of May's speech at the last Free Palestine rally that was held on Sunday. So let's go to that now.
I can't tell you how it feels to see your faces in the crowd today. It has been a very difficult few months, but particularly the last week, listening to so-called President Trump talking about how he'll turn Palestine into the Riviera of the sea, outwardly talking about stealing Palestinian land, outwardly talking about dispossessing and driving Palestinians from their homes and their land, condescendingly telling us, we'll build something beautiful. Well, here I am to tell you, Trump, we will build something beautiful. It is called Palestine. We do not need your empty, capitalist, imperialist aims. But he has made something very clear. America's role in the persecution of Palestinians. He has made something very clear that Israel did not commit his atrocities alone. That it had the backing and the funding and the support of the biggest military might in the world. Yes, terrorist. But that does tell us that Israel's colonial ambitions is not just unique to Palestine. In this country, this state was founded on colonial ambitions, and its indigenous people were massacred. So I'd like to take that moment to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations in which we stand today, that this land was never ceded, that this land will always be indigenous Aboriginal land, that its people are still here, and we stand by them side by side in solidarity. We know our fight is their fight, and their fight is ours. And we have seen this in this movement for the last 16, 17 months, and it has left our politicians and mainstream media scrambling, shocked that actually we have solidarity in this country. Because for decades and generations, anti-Palestinian racism has been able to run rife and rampant, and we have been silenced and pigeonholed into a corner. Well, no more! No more! No more are we silent! No more will we be put back into that box and only brought out when they've got something to say about us that doesn't include us. The amount of times we've had politicians, we've had media tell us about our stories, tell us what we think and feel, but not once talk to a Palestinian. Not once put them our voices. But we, everyday people, we stand together. Our voices are shared. When I speak to family in Gaza, and in the West Bank, and they are living in some of the most horrible conditions you can imagine in humanity. And just last night, my auntie was telling me that the Zionist settlers were roaming the town in the middle of the night with the Kalashnikovs and their weapons, and the soldiers were protecting them so they could try and harass Palestinians, and they could try and beat up and murder them. They were still hopeful. They were still hopeful, and they were still sitting there. There's a word in Palestine and Arabic that we say, sumud, sitting patiently, not quietly, knowing that we will have our liberation. And they are sitting and hearing the stories of our movement around the world. Hearing your voices speak up for Palestine here in Melbourne. Hearing the stories of voices for Palestine speaking up in our workplaces, in our local councils, in our schools. And that means something. The Zionist lobby and its supporters only have one thing they can enact, and that is fear and hate and intimidation. They do not understand the word love, compassion, care, justice, humanity. They do not understand the pain of watching people die needlessly, violently, for their violence and their hate, because they spew hate. And as Nelson has said, and as we've said in this movement, we are a movement of peace and love. That is why we come out every week. I would like to also say, yes, we are moving to monthly rallies. That does not mean we have stopped. We are only beginning.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
We are only beginning. There is so much work to do. But now we have a movement behind us. A movement that recognises that Palestinian voices mean something. A movement that recognises that the Palestinian cause is a cause for every single person. For everyone who is dispossessed, for every person who is persecuted. Because we are inclusive and welcoming, and we share love. I do want to mention a Palestinian woman activist who's also inspired me in this movement, but also as a fellow Palestinian, where we can talk about our stories. Her name is Noura Mansour. She's sitting right over here. And we are a community. But there is one speech that she gave that always resonates with me, which talks about that we have hope. And you have shown us, every single one of you, you have shown us what that hope looks like. But we also have more than hope. We have more than that hope. We have something even more stronger. We have each other. And that is what they're scared of. And something Samantha Ratner made that very clear. We have each other. I cannot say how moving and powerful it is to hear a politician come up on this stage and say it how it is. I cannot tell you how it feels to finally hear that we have an ability to let the Zionists out there know that we can organize and we can hold you accountable and we will vote you out. So I'm going to ask every single one of you here today to make a promise that you will not stop, that you will not be silenced, that you will not be intimidated, that you will speak about Palestine, you will campaign about Palestine, and we will come out every month, every day, every second. Is that a promise, everyone? Racist out there. When we say from the river to the sea, we mean equality for every single person. Everyone. Thank you.
And that was the amazing Mae Saif, who is a Palestinian activist, if that wasn't clear, a Free Palestine Melbourne organiser and a member of the Palestinian Community Association for Victoria. And that wasn't recorded last Sunday because, of course, the rallies are now monthly. It was recorded on the 16th of February, which was, I believe, the last rally. I'm not sure when the next one is. Do you know when it is?
Oh, I saw it yesterday in my searches.
I was just looking it up. Well,
we'll announce it.
We will
at the end of the show.
Right. Are we going to go to? Are we going to have a discussion about things? Oh, we were talking here in the studio about the real threat that's happening at the moment to free speech under the guise of, you know.
Social cohesion,
unity. These are words that were used as I was growing up in Malaysia as an excuse to clamp down on any dissent and media freedom and things like that. And it really chills me to see what's happening here and in the States. I mean, the detention of Mohamed Khalil is just such a frightening development.
Yeah. I saw that maybe, well, there's a hope that it will be quashed by the High Court or Supreme Court, I can't remember which one, in the US,
that basically Court, I would imagine.
It'll be found unlawful.
Except that, of course, the Supreme Court has been stacked by the right, the Republicans over the past decades, and whether they will be at all inclined to stand up to this overreach of executive power remains to be seen.
Yes. It's very scary. And, you know, of course, here as well, there's a lot of assaults on our right to protest. And just the cynical use of language is what really frustrates me. And of course, you know, they're trying to couch it in language that might be more tolerable or can get past, you know, people's critical thinking faculties. And I find that frustrating because it can work when, and it sounds like kind of reasonable, like, yeah, social cohesion, like when you, especially when you have this huge apparatus of this media apparatus that's really fostering and manufacturing that consent and this environment that allows for these things to sound reasonable.
And the way in which something that they know was not real, that was a staged event that actually caused a change in the legislation to mandate, to have mandatory minimum sentencing for quote unquote hate speech. That's now on the law books. And again, I find it terrifying that it's, that we've got these changes that really undermine and erode our freedom of speech, that were there and that they know. And they probably knew a long time ago. I mean, all the evidence points to them knowing almost immediately that this was a con job. I mean, it was called out on Twitter by people like Barry Cassidy, who as being a con job. And yet we're stuck with it now. There's no effort to repeal. Sorry, Nita.
No, I was just agreeing with you fully. And I'm just thinking about Hash Tahir, who's facing prosecution for chanting at the rally, All Zionists are Terrorists, which is a very common chant at the rally. And it's beyond terrifying. And I think the laws that they have dug up to basically prosecute him, some laws that most people would agree are really archaic and oppressive, which used to be used for insulting police, which tells you everything about that, you know. And sometimes I think about it all and I think, could you do better as a fascist than this society that we're living in? Like, could you do better than this, you know? Like full control of the discourse, complete oppression, and also I think just, you know, so many controls on people that it's sort of as if, you know, just sleepwalking into a more dystopic future. I feel like we need to kind of rise up, but I don't know Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that May Safe at the end of the rally felt that she needed to qualify the words that she had said to say that it includes everyone and things like that, I think is a sign of the times that we're living in. On which note, I think that we should maybe play some community announcements because we've got our next interview coming up soon.
Sounds good.
After these announcements, we'll be talking to you again.
Are you stressed about your home loan? Right now, more Victorians than ever are stressed about home loan repayments. If you're going through a period of temporary financial hardship, you can ask your lender for hardship assistance. Lenders can agree to reduce your interest rate, extend the term of your loan, freeze interest, put a temporary hold on payments, or reduce your payments. If you only own one property that you live in, and either you are affected by family violence or your household earnings are less than $75,000, contact Mortgage Stress Victoria for free help from a lawyer, social worker, or financial counsellor on 1800 572 292 or www.mortgagestress.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
Hi everyone, my name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
And next, coming up now is we've got Gail Page on the line. Gail's a human resources professional. I was going to say human rights because that's more the sort of person we have on this show, who is semi-retired and started doing assignments for Médecins Sans Frontières in 2022. At that time, she was in Afghanistan for 8 months, and then she's worked twice for the Palestine Project, based out of Jerusalem in 2023 and 2024. She returned from her last assignment for Palestine in December, and in both places, she was in a strongly people-focused role, passionate about supporting the local colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Gail.
Thank you, Sonia. It's nice to be here.
Now, to start off with, could you give us a brief overview of your experiences with MSF and the roles you were playing? I mean, I discussed it briefly, but if you could give us some more details.
Sure. As you said, I joined in June 2022 as a HR manager in Kabul. Was there for 8 months. So basically, as your normal HR manager in Australia, my role was oversight of payroll, recruitment, induction, training, etc. Kabul was the coordination base for all of the projects in Afghanistan, so about 8 at the time. I worked with a team of 2 women in the HR office, and also we had about 6 or 8 cleaners who looked after the guest houses. So we were looking after the Kabul base, about 170 local staff, security, drivers, supply, cleaners, etc. My next role was in for the Palestine from June 2023 to November 2023, so 5 months based in East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Again, I was HR role and learning and development manager for that particular mission. So that was for Gaza and Nablus in the West Bank. So again, working in the coordination headquarters in East Jerusalem. Review of payrolls, policy advice, local labour laws, training. I visited Gaza for 2 weeks in August 2023 to put together the training plan and cover the HR manager there. After the 7th of October 2023, I was the primary contact for the local staff in Gaza after the conflict started. So communication was via text messages, WhatsApp groups, tracking locations, family members, health issues, access to cash and medicines, took over the payroll basically and monitoring people who were outside of Gaza when the 7th of October occurred.
Mm.
I went back in June 2024 for 6 months, basically in the same role, but another colleague was tracking the local staff in Gaza under the duty of care function we had. So I guess I was able to provide some background and continuity for the team. There was pretty high turnover. People couldn't stay very long. And supporting the Gaza HR team with the usual services, setting up the new modular field hospital induction program. I visited Nablus 6 or 7 times to do some workshops and support there.
That's a huge amount of work. Perhaps we can start off by talking a little bit more about your time in Afghanistan. What were the main challenges that your local colleagues were facing?
So I guess the Taliban took over in August 2021, so I was there for the 12-month anniversary. The initial challenges for local colleagues, in particular the women who were working with me, there was a department, prevention, advice and promotion of virtue. So they would pull over women travelling in shared taxis with males, not moving about without a male chaperone, dress code, types of things that were in shops. Mm. And gradually there were more and more restrictions on women in Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
The events while I was there, there was in October 2022, there was a bomb blast that killed teenagers who were sitting a practice exam. That included the 16-year-old sister of one of our female colleagues, so that was very sad. There was obviously bomb blasts and drone strikes, and so movement was, quite risky and unpredictable. Then there was the directive on the 24th of December 2022 banning women from working in NGOs except for health and education sectors. So they were still able to work for MSF, but everyone was very worried that what will happen next, what's the next stage of this, will they stop us from coming to work?
Mm.
Some of these women were the primary breadwinners for the family.
Mm-hmm.
They had trouble travelling to work. We had one woman who was standing in the snow for an hour. None of the taxis would pick her up. Problems at the bus stop. Private taxis were risky.
So the taxis wouldn't pick her up because they were afraid of repercussions, or?
Yeah, because there was a man in the taxi and an unaccompanied female would get in, so they would be stopped, particularly if they're all, jammed into a shared taxi.
Mm-hmm.
Private taxis were available, but still risky. And so often they would come to work really early before the Department of the Prevention of, Vice, et cetera, were on the street. Mm-hmm. So they would often be at work by 6 o'clock, even though they didn't start until 8. And, of course, the other bans that we've read about, attending secondary school, university, going to parks. I said to one of my colleagues, oh, does that mean your husband will take the children to the park? And she said, no, he won't take them. So really it was impacting on children going to the park, playing sports. Afghanistan's a big sporting country. MSF did organise discussion forums for the women who are working for us. And we had some online attendance at the international board meeting, which was great. Gave the people from the HR team and the projects an opportunity to talk about it, mm-hmm. talk about the psychological impact, isolation, you know, lack of education, no voice, etc. And so it was quite a difficult time for them, imagining how this might progress.
And can you tell us what happened after you left? Were they and is MSF still working in Afghanistan? How have things progressed in the sort of 18 months or so since you left Afghanistan?
Yes, so they are still working there. In fact, I heard from one of my colleagues just recently. She sent me a note to say she'd done another presentation about the challenges for women. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the issues continue. It's not easy for them. They still come to work. They're strong and determined to be able to do that. I think, you know, we read in the paper there's more and more restrictions about speaking in public, et cetera. So it must be very difficult for them.
I mean, the idea that you need to be strong and determined just to show up for work, just to be able to provide for your family, is one that I find absolutely chilling. That, you know, things that we take so much for granted and that we don't, not even appreciate the idea that turning up for work is a privilege is just, scary. Maybe we could move on to Palestine. Could you tell us a bit about the conditions and challenges your local colleagues there were facing?
I'll set the context perhaps before the 7th of October, when I had my visit to Gaza. There was some great work being done, particularly in the Gaza clinic. They had 3D technology that were working on masks for burns. I was doing the training plan. There were well-educated staff members who were experts in their field. We went to a university master's presentation of one of our colleagues. We could move around freely in the green zone, so there were social activities, volleyball, juice cafes. We went to an amputee football grand final, which was sponsored by the Red Cross. It was still difficult.
Just to interrupt for a second, the idea that there was an amputee football grand final shows that the violence predates anything that happened on the 7th of October.
But that's right. There were many military waves. I think someone referred to it recently. And, you know, they pointed out to me when we're standing in front of the clinic, oh, this is where the bombing happened last time. Mm-hmm. So there was this recurring, uncertainty that they were living with. And there were people living in refugee camps.
Yep.
So after the 7th of October, I guess, my job was to be in communication. The local staff there were told not to go to work. People were ordered to leave their homes with only a few hours' notice. They reported to us family members were killed and their homes were destroyed. There was one terrible night when all the communications were cut off. We had employees outside of Gaza who were communicating to us to say, look, they've cut off all the communications. So we had no idea what was going on. That was the sleepless night for everyone, I think. Things that they would ask about, that, you know, where do we get food? People were queuing for a long time. Water obviously was a problem. We were doing the payroll in Jerusalem for them, giving extra solidarity payments, but there was issues with cash, shelter. So we obviously had colleagues who were pregnant or new mothers or people with long-term health problems. Some people reported that they'd moved 3 or 4 times, and that was in the first month that I was there. Colleagues in the south had many family members come to live with them, you know, 5 families in one house. We provided psychological support, but by telephone. So there was a combination, obviously, of mental health issues, insomnia, stress, anxiety, loss, exhaustion. Of course, one of our employees on the 6th of November was Mohammed Ahel was killed. So that was the impact on the whole team. He died as part of the conflict. We organised vehicle movements and they were problematic. Local staff continued to work. In the WhatsApp group, we had people who would share their stories. And this was on the 8th day. One that I particularly remember is someone who'd worked in our admin team who's very organised. And her response was to set up a plan and have an evacuation list. So gathered her four kids and her husband together and got organised, prepared their bags, told the children, you know, you can only take three things, decided who was going to do what. And then she said after that she felt confident that it gave her a feeling that she was prepared. And then within the same day, there was a huge bombardment and they had to leave. And she said, look, that plan went out the window. We didn't even wear our shoes. We didn't close the door. So, you know, trying to prepare in the heat of the moment was very difficult. So these are just some of the stories in the first month of all of this going on. So quite difficult for people.
Indeed. Before the genocide was starting, can you tell us a bit about the position of the women within the communities that you were working with? Were they, like in Afghanistan, often the sole provider for their families and things like that? What was the working conditions they were in and things like that?
There was a range of working positions in, you know, it was a medical team, obviously.
Yeah. And how big was the team that you were working with? Perhaps just to give us an idea of that diversity as well.
Sorry, what was that?
How large was the team in Gaza at the time?
Look, I think it was about 260 local employees at the time. And, you know, medical teams, support teams, you know, a mixture of, you know, all different diversity within the team. There were some people who were, you know, young, not married. There were some people who'd been working in the organisation for a very long time. Yeah, just a diversity of people, the same as you would have. Some people started early to pick up their kids from school. They all worked very hard and were very, very, very organised and had been, you know, doing this role for quite some time in Gaza. And also I worked with the West Bank team as well. You know, they were obviously set up a new mobile team for primary health care there. They have problems with road blockages or delays at checkpoint, which meant that they couldn't see everyone that they had booked in.
And when when you say they had problems, could you elaborate a bit on that? What does that look like?
Okay, so there's checkpoints when they had to go out to the various points where they had the medical mobile clinic set up. So sometimes the checkpoints would be held up because maybe there were some Israeli vehicles coming through. There was one day where we were held at a checkpoint because there were Israeli vehicles coming in through the checkpoint. Sometimes roads were blocked for no reason, and so therefore there was a delay. And so it meant that they couldn't see everybody that they'd had booked in. The military presence at the checkpoint, I guess, had increased. There were new gates put up that when we were driving each time, we would go, oh, hold on, that's blocking. They can just close that gate and block that that road. So they were worried that things would escalate as they had in Gaza and were working to prepare for that, yes.
Yep. One last question. What is your message for Australians in terms of the genocide happening in Gaza?
Look, I guess I should note that MSF, being a medical humanitarian organisation, you know, we don't have the legal authority to assess intentionality whether Gaza is happening. But I guess our teams have witnessed on the ground through the conflict, you know, what's happening there, mass killing, severe physical and mental. So encourage Australians to keep up their support of Gaza and the West Bank. The level of destruction will take many years to recover. It's a massive humanitarian disaster. Civil infrastructure, community infrastructure needs to rebuild. I mean, hopefully there's some great Australian businesses out there who can help. Specialist medical interventions. MSF is running a Vote for Humanity campaign in this upcoming election. Sharing key messages. So, I mean, encouraging people to vote along with their values. And I guess advocate where you can, you know, join MSF if you want to, or other humanitarian organisations, donate, keep these organisations in Gaza and the West Bank doing the great work that they do. And look, I have to, you know, I have the utmost respect for my MSF colleagues who have been to work in Gaza. over the last 15 months. Some of them have return assignments. So it's difficult, and we need to support people who actually go and do that.
Great. Thank you very much, Gail, for your time this morning. That was Gail Page, who is a human resources manager with Médecins Sans Frontières and was in Jerusalem in 2023 and 2024, both before and after the 7th of October. I think that might be our final guest for this morning.
Yes. So we can play an announcement or we can go to some events, I think.
Shall we do some community announcements first and see what's coming up?
Let's have a look.
Would you like to start off with something, Jesse? I've got a couple as well.
Absolutely. So tonight there is a vigil at 8:30 p.m. outside the SPS office in Federation Square in honour of the martyrs and those who have been massacred in the coastal area of Syria.
Also tonight, at the Black Spark Cultural Centre, which is 126A Gladstone Avenue in Northcote, there is a Rising Tide reading group. What they're actually reading was not yet announced when the notice went up. So,
okay. Well, I'm sure it'll be very interesting and related to climate.
Exactly, I'd say. Activism probably is what I would guess. But yeah.
On Saturday, this Saturday from 6 p.m, there is an iftar, potluck, poetry and panel discussions hosted by Anak Bangsa Merdeka, and the theme is celebrating women freedom fighters.
I'm sticking with the Black Spark Cultural Centre, and on Sunday there is an Understanding Palestine lecture, part of the series by Yusuf Al-Ramawi. This one's themed with International Women's Day, and it's Women of the Resistance. If you have a look at the poster, there's this great picture of a Palestinian woman facing off to a gunman with, she appears to have a stone in her hand, as opposed to the bullets coming out of the machine gun she faces.
Mm-hmm. And on Saturday, this Saturday, the March 15th, there is a She Matters Stop Killing Women rally, and that starts at 11:30. And the rallies will bring attention to Australia's femicide epidemic while calling for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and opposition leader Peter Dutton and Premier Jacinda Allen to roll out meaningful budgetary measures, policy, legal challenges and action to end violence against women in our country. Already 12 women have been killed this year, and last year 101 women were lost. The rally organisers are Australian Femicide Watch and the Red Heart Campaign, led by the amazing Shirley Moody. And they're asking people to bring protest signs, electric candles and flowers. And lastly, speaking about freedom of speech and protest laws and cracking down on those things, there's for next Wednesday, the 19th, the Victorian state government is planning new laws to restrict protests introduced under the cover of so-called social cohesion. And those measures include a ban on wearing masks, preventing protesters from being COVID safe or shielding themselves from police use of capsicum spray, restrictions on symbols of resistance, including flags, and of course things like locks and ropes and glue, which are often used in acts of peaceful disobedience, and the requirements for multicultural organizations to sign a quote-unquote social cohesion pledge to receive public funding, which forces loyalty to government narratives, as well as the creation of quote-unquote safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of Melbourne CBD off limits for public assembly. And of course, this is this legislation is a direct attack on our democracy, on our ability to dissent and to protest these laws. And it cynically targets pro-Palestine activism while threatening all movements that fight for justice, from First Nations rights to environmental action, workers' union, refugee rights and anti-war campaigns. So there will be protests across all of Australia. And this one is starting from 5:30 p.m. at the State Library next Wednesday.
And hopefully we'll have an interview next week. I'm trying to line something up with one of the speakers to have on this show. So, yeah, it's something that, as we were talking about earlier, we I think all of us quite passionate about and believe firmly that these things need to be protected.
Absolutely. Hence 3CR doing the amazing things 3CR does.
Indeed. I think that might be all the community announcements. Do we want, although we could just talk about the, apologies for pronunciation here, Biraranga Film Festival, which is on until the 18th of March. I can't quite see the details there because Jesse's in the way.
Oh, it's on in Northcote at the cinema there, which I can't remember the name. Westgarth?
The Westgarth,
yeah, Westgarth, that's where it is. It's from the 13th, so beginning tomorrow, for 5 days. Gosh, until yes. The 18th.
I was thinking that we were already into the 13th, but no, it starts tomorrow, so yeah. That looks like it'll be really good. So head on to the Westgarth.
Oh, and also I've just seen, which I meant to mention, the March for Native Forests.
Oh, yeah.
That's on the 23rd. And that's outside MP Peter Khalil's office on Sydney Road, beginning at 10:30 a.m.
Right. I think that's probably it now. That's the final community announcements.
Yes.
Two after the final one.
Yes.
So, pardon? Should we do what we had on the show this morning?
Yeah.
The last interview that we had was with Gail Page, Human Resources Manager for Médecins Sans Frontières, talking about her experience and, more to the point, I think the experiences of her colleagues in Médecins Sans Frontières, both in Palestine and in Afghanistan.
Before that, we had a speech by wonderful Palestinian activist Mai Saif. At the
16th of February rally here in Nam. And before that,
we had an interview I did with Sasha Gillies-Lukakis regarding Cuba, the history of Cuba, and it's part of a series that we'll be playing over the next few weeks, focusing on the country and the history and the future for the country.
And in a fortnight, we'll have a very Cuba-heavy episode because we're hoping to have not just the latest from Sasha, the next installment from Sasha, but we will also be speaking with Bob Price about socialism in Cuba and the hope for the future.
It might be a different perspective as well.
Indeed.
We'll see.
So it'll be interesting to hear that. Stay tuned now for Stick Together.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.